The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payton for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Associated Press and the Religion News Service. Our first article was published by the Associated Press on September 27, written by David Crary and Holly Meyer. Jews and Catholics warn against Trump's latest loyalty test for religious voters. Former President Donald Trump recently reissued his loyalty test to religious Americans, declaring that he can best protect their freedoms while preemptively blaming members of certain faiths should he lose the presidential election in November. Jews and Catholics can vote for him and ace the test, but those who don't, he says, need their head examined. If he loses, Trump added, Jewish people would have a lot to do with the loss. Among the Jewish leaders appalled at Trump's remarks was Rabbi Rick Jacobs, president of the Union for Reform Judaism, an umbrella group for more than 800 Reform synagogues in North America. Your words preemptively blaming Jews for your potential election loss is of a piece with millennia of anti-Semitic lies about Jewish power, Jacobs said in a social media post. It puts a target on American Jews, and it makes you an ally not to our vulnerable community, but to those who wish us harm. Stop. Trump's speeches for years have hewed to divisive us versus them messaging. But tying those themes to specific religious Americans who oppose him is out of line and even dangerous, according to rhetoric experts. Non-Jews shouldn't express public opinion about what is or isn't good Judaism, and non-Catholics shouldn't expose public opinions about what is or isn't good Catholicism, said Stephen Millies, a public theology professor at the Catholic Theological Union in Chicago. Not only is it bad form, but it's also an ignorant waste of oxygen. Asked to respond to criticism from Jewish leaders, Trump campaign press secretary Caroline Leavitt sent statements from herself and several of Trump's Jewish supporters. The statements did not directly address the potential blaming of Jews for a Trump defeat. Rather, they depicted Trump as a stronger supporter of Israel than President Joe Biden and Trump's Democratic opponent, Vice President Kamala Harris. Jewish Americans and Jewish leaders around the world recognize that Donald Trump did more for them and the state of Israel than any president in history, Leavitt said. The bottom line is that Kamala Harris and Joe Biden cave to far left extremists and terrorists, while President Trump will protect Jewish Americans and put American citizens first. Trump's latest provocative comments came in a span of 4 days. His warnings about Jewish voters were in September 19 speeches to Jewish donors and the Israeli-American Council in Washington. His remarks about Catholics came on September 22 in a post on Truth Social. Matthew Bodie, who studies religious rhetoric as a professor at the University of North Georgia, said Trump has adopted spiritual warfare rhetoric, which is commonplace in certain Christian circles. Those who gave him that rhetoric saw Satan or evil as the enemy. Now that enemy is anyone, Jew, Christian, Muslim, who stands in his way, Bodie said, calling it dangerous to democracy and religion. Trump always makes his religious followers, especially Christians, choose. They have to choose him over pluralism, over morality, over evangelicalism, said Bodie, a Protestant. If God is already on your side theologically, it's not a far leap to say he should be on your side politically. That isn't new to American politics, Bodie said. Trump is only making that divide advantageous to him. He's furthering that which was there, but he is also adding his own weight to it, making it worse. David Gibson, director of the Center on Religion and Culture at Jesuit-run Fordham University, said that in past elections, for a non-Catholic like Trump to be setting himself up as the savior of Catholics, or Jews for that matter, would have been political insanity. But it's Trump, and conservatives who would attack a Democrat for such language are cheering for the Republican nominee, Gibson added in an email. There are many reasons. The most obvious is that they like Trump more than they need their own church. Gibson also suggested that Trump's tough stance on immigration, which includes calls for mass deportations, is at odds with Catholic teaching. Catholics listening to the increasingly nativist rhetoric on immigration from Trump, and even his running mate, J.D. Vance, who converted to Catholicism in 2019, ought to have their hearts examined if they supply that, Gibson said. Professor Jennifer McKeerker, a historian of American political rhetoric at Texas A&M University, said typical politicians seek to connect to voters based on shared policy beliefs, not by demanding religious loyalty. But Trump isn't a typical politician, and he's very concerned about loyalty, she said. He divides the world up into us versus them and tries to use those divisions to gain power. It's especially dangerous to attempt to divide people based upon religious identity, she said, author of Demagogue for President, The Rhetorical Genius of Donald Trump. The kind of language Trump is using here is more like that used by authoritarian personality cult leader. Trump's recent comment about blaming Jews if he loses came at an event that also featured Jewish mega donor Miriam Adelson, widow of the late casino magnate Sheldon Adelson. She introduced Trump as a true friend of the Jewish people. Among the pro-Trump statements provided to the Associated Press by Levitt was one from Eli Kohanim, who served during the Trump administration as Deputy Special Envoy for Combating Antisemitism. Trump is absolutely correct in challenging our assumptions about voting on autopilot and failing to comprehend that the Democrat Party, which has been hijacked by the far-left base, is no longer a home for the Jewish people, Kohanim's statement said. Adelson and Kohanim represent the portion of U.S. Jews that strongly supports Trump. In 2020, he received about 30% of Jewish Americans' votes, compared to 70% for Biden, according to AP VoteCast. The criticism of Trump's recent remarks came from the center as well as from the left of the national Jewish community. The American Jewish Community, a prominent advocacy group that strives to broadly represent Jews in the U.S. and abroad, issued a sharply critical statement. It took issue with Trump's suggestion that if 40% of the U.S. Jewish electorate voted for him, that means 60% are voting for the enemy. Setting up anyone to say, we lost because of the Jews, is outrageous and dangerous, the AJC said. Thousands of years of history have shown that scapegoating Jews can lead to anti-Semitic hate and violence. Some Jews will vote for President Trump, and some will vote for Vice President Harris, the AJC added. None of us, by supporting the candidate we choose, is voting for the enemy. To the left of center, a harsh denunciation of Trump came from Lauren Manas, political director of If Not Now, an organization of U.S. Jews that has accused the Israeli government of oppressive policies toward Palestinians and protested Israel's military offensive in Gaza. Trump doubled down on his long-standing pattern of scapegoating Jews, Manas said. Make no mistake, this is a clear and flagrant instruction to his fanatical base of extremists to target Jews with retributive violence if he should lose. Some Jews found a positive twist to Trump's remarks. As Betsy Frank of Mattituck, New York, conveyed in a letter published September 23 in the New York Times. As a proud Jewish woman who believes in Israel's right to defend itself, but supports the United States and everything it stands for even more, I would not vote for Donald Trump for any office, she wrote. If he loses the election, I will gladly take the blame. Now an article published by the Religion News Service on September 25 and written by Genevieve Charles. The Tenement Museum launches its Lived Religion series with a High Holidays tour. New York. The Tenement Museum in Manhattan's Lower East Side kicked off a Lived Religion series on September 22 by immersing visitors into the High Holiday celebrations and shared apartments of 20th century Eastern European Jewish immigrants. The tour is the first in a series that will help visitors understand religious tradition and holidays outside houses of worship and instead inside homes and neighborhoods. The museum aims to elevate stories of past immigrants, migrants, and refugees at a time when the country is divided over immigration policy. I just hope people think about what it's like to be a newcomer in a city. In a city like New York that has so many pulls, said Annie Pollard, professor of the Tenement Museum. What it's like for individuals, for families and communities to think about how to recreate their holidays and their holiday calendar here in New York. During the 10 days that begin with Rosh Hashanah and conclude with Yom Kippur, those in the tenement apartments refocus their individual concerns to the concerns of the collective, solemnly seeking forgiveness from others and from God, Pollan added. The idea for the tour was inspired by museum staff finding a pair of High Holidays tickets from 1908 under the floorboards of one of its tenements. At the turn of the 20th century, the Lower East Side hosted a large Yiddish-speaking Jewish community. More than 400 synagogues operated inside rented spaces such as movie theaters and dance halls. The tour explores the tension of how Jewish immigrants adapted to life in New York, including the work week, and how women in particular kept religious practices alive in their families, including through food. Over the high holidays, the tenement's Jewish families sipped chicken soup, sang music of the cantor, and baked challah. Food historian and special guest to the museum, Sarah Lohman, provides a cooking demonstration on the tour, drawing from the first popular Yiddish cookbook, published by Hindey Amhanitsky in 1901. There are food items that are passed down through a family that it would not be the holidays unless she made it, Lohman said. It's one of the times where assimilation fails in some ways, that we manage to maintain our cultural heritage around these holidays. Visitors taste Lohman's citron cake, a modern version of one of the recipes to symbolize something sweet in place of the traditional apples or honey to celebrate Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. Using Yitreng, the recipe also incorporates a nod to Sukkot, which comes after the High Holidays. The tours are limited to 30 visitors to keep the experience as intimate as possible, according to Catherine Lloyd, Vice President of Programs and Interpretation at the museum. Throughout the fall and early 2025, the museum will host tours, tastings, and talks, including lived religion programs for Christmas, Lunar New Year, and Ramadan. The goal is to have visitors ponder common themes such as collective responsibility and forgiveness, Lloyd said. While the next High Holidays tour on September 29 is sold out, a virtual tour on October 29 will highlight a hidden magical economy on the 19th century Lower East Side, and how immigrant women such as a famous palm reader influenced America's interest in spiritualism at the time. In December, a Christmas in Klein Deutschland tour will be held every weekend and will explore new research from the 1870s German newspapers and the stories of local German saloon owners, as well as Italian and Puerto Rican families, to show how debates over Christian celebrations help shape their national identities in the U.S. This fall, we look forward to offering New Yorkers and visitors from across the country dynamic opportunities to engage with personal migration stories that shine light not only on diverse cultural tradition, but the patterns of history and the way in which the migrant experience is fundamental to what it means to be American, Pollan said in a statement. Our next article was published by the Associated Press on September 7 and written by Luis André Hinao, how a river captain converted to religion by an evangelist built the mother house of country music. Nashville, Tennessee. Nashville's Ryman Auditorium is known as the mother church of country music. And indeed, it began as a church built by a riverboat captain who was converted to religion by an evangelist. More than 130 years after it was built as the non-denominational Union Gospel Tabernacle, Music City's most revered concert venue retains its religious roots. Thousands have filled its original wooden pews surrounded by colorful stained glass windows to listen to stars ranging from Johnny Cash and Dolly Parton to Prince, Taylor Swift, and Elvis, the king of rock and roll. Technically, it's a building, but it's clearly a living entity of some sort, said Jesse Woods, a tourist from Massachusetts. She toured the Ryman Museums in the morning of a recent visit and attended a performance by the band Postmodern Jukebox in the evening. It all started with the Reverend Samuel Jones, an evangelist who came from Georgia to Nashville in 1885 for revival, sponsored by local churches under a huge tent. Tom Ryman, a wealthy captain who served whiskey in his steamship line, took offense. So he rounded up a group of his friends to attend the revival and beat up Jones. Instead, the story goes that after one sermon, the preacher convinced him to give his life to God. Ryman stopped selling alcohol on his ships. He wouldn't even Christian steamships with champagne, and instead used jugs of water. He also began to dream about building a house of worship in Nashville for religious gatherings, so evangelists like Jones could have a place to preach. Through his funding and with the help of donations from the community, the Union Gospel Tabernacle officially opened on May 4, 1892, with a music festival. The tabernacle did not have a dedicated congregation, said Ryman Auditorium curator Joshua Braunberg. It was more of a place for, say, like a traveling evangelist to preach in, such as a Billy Sunday or Gypsy Smith or Samuel Jones, Braunberg said. After Ryman's death, it was renamed after him, and it went on to become revered as one of America's leading music venues. What was built as a religious meeting place for Nashvillians, the auditorium says on its site, became a different type of sanctuary that grew bigger than Ryman could ever have imagined. For its first two decades or so, it was a hybrid gathering place, hosting religious leaders and some of the biggest names in ballet, opera, and theater. It became known as the Carnegie Hall of the South. We've had all sorts of progressive events, suffrage events, scientific demonstrations, magicians, all kinds of political icons and cultural icons have graced the stage, Braunberg said. You also have had bizarre things. We've had boxing matches, circuses. And alongside, we had funerals. We had civil rights protests. If you had any kind of significant event in the city, it was here. It went on to host meetings of the Southern Baptist Convention, memorable performances by big names, such as comedian Charlie Chaplin and magician Harry Houdini, and appearances on stage by President Teddy Roosevelt and the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. The venue also became known for its unique acoustics, beloved by artists. It's Ryman Auditorium's roots as a church that resulted in its impressive acoustics, the Ryman site says, as the auditorium was constructed to project the voices, songs, and instruments of weekly church services. It also became the home of the Grand Ole Opry, the most famous country music and entertainment show of its time, from 1943 to 1974. The show was transmitted using the world's tallest radio tower at the time, built just outside of Nashville, bringing country music to living rooms from California to New York for the first time, the site says. Audiences across the U.S. had discovered a love for country music. After the Grand Ole Opry left, the Ryman was vacant for nearly two decades and fell into disrepair. It was restored thanks to donations by artists and members of the community, and reopened in the 1990s, and now has a seating capacity of 2,362. Today, lovers of country music and other genres travel to the Ryman from across America and sit on its pews. It's lovingly known as the soul of Nashville. It definitely has a soul feel, said Woods, the Massachusetts tourist, and I don't believe it's just because of the musical acts that have been there, but there's a palpable energy, for sure. Our last article was published by the Religion News Service on September 24 and written by J. Jeffrey McDonald. Church Property Conference offers congregations more than prayer to keep their buildings. As many as 100,000 church-owned buildings are expected to be sold or repurposed by 2030, according to an analysis in a new book, Gone for Good: Negotiating the Coming Wave of Church Property Transition. Though Sunday attendance has recovered in part from COVID-19 restrictions, a decades-long decline has continued to take its toll, and the squeeze on churches has only gotten tighter in the post-pandemic economy, according to fall 2023 data from the Hartford Institute for Religion Research. As a result, congregations face hard choices about what to do with large sacred structures that are underutilized, costly to keep up, and suffering from deferred maintenance. Everything keeps getting more expensive, but we have fewer people in the congregation to pay for it, said Janine Gambaro, a member of Franklin Reformed Church in Nutley, New Jersey. We keep going by the grace of God, but it's an issue. Gambaro was one of some 100 church leaders and congregants who gathered online and in person September 20 and 21 to hear from a lineup of real estate experts about how to reimagine a new future for church buildings. The Future of Church Property Conference, organized by Princeton Theological Seminary, focused on turning community needs into grants, partnerships with developers, and new business-driven income streams. Thanks to the Federal Inflation Reduction Act, lots of new dollars are available for renovations, said Lindsay Baker, CEO of the International Living Future Institute, an advocacy group for making buildings healthier, greener, and more affordable. There's a lot of money for you all right now, and that's not always the case, so that's exciting, said Baker. Congregations were urged to consider social enterprise, a term for using business principles to address social problems while generating revenue. Attendees heard about congregations that had escaped financial dire straits and galvanized new ministry momentum by leasing space to the public for community and commercial use. Sunset Ridge Church of Christ in San Antonio leases a former junk room to NYX Wellness, which painted walls and began offering yoga classes, and now brings in $650 per month for the church. Sunset Ridge's commercial quality kitchen is now used by entrepreneurs to prepare food for retail sale for another $400 per user per month. A co-working space brings together remote workers on a membership model. Each user pays $75 per month for unlimited access. Getting the congregation on board for these innovations involved many coffee chats with the congregation, in which pastoral leaders listened to fears and answered questions, according to Jess Lowry, executive director and pastoral leader of the Sunset Ridge Collective, which coordinates the church's social enterprises. That time we invested ended up really helping people get ownership and understand, Lowry said. Even if they weren't moved to participate in some part of the particular mission, they at least felt safe and comfortable that they weren't just losing their church. The assembled church leaders were directed to resources such as the Good Futures Accelerator course from Rooted Good for other ideas on how to forward their missions while raising revenue. Churches with land or buildings that can be developed into housing have huge opportunities in the current housing crisis, according to Nina Janopol, president of Virginia Episcopal Real Estate Partners. She pointed to Arlington Presbyterian Church across the Potomac River from Washington, which built 173 affordable housing units, working with a nonprofit developer who pieced together $71 million in direct funding and tax breaks for the project from multiple sources. The lofty visions presented at the conference were partly tempered by financial realities, and congregations where even paying utility bills is a challenge. That's how we got into this mess, all of us, because there wasn't money to say, oh, let's just fix this when something comes up, said the Reverend Megan Manis, pastor of Clinton Presbyterian Church in Clinton, Massachusetts. We've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. I hope you'll listen again next time and that you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.